The stone floor had been cold for so long that Alara no longer felt the difference between the dungeon and her own skin. Both were the same temperature now, somewhere below what living things should be, and the wound on her left side had stopped bleeding 2 hours ago, which was either a sign her body was healing or a sign it had run out of blood to give. She pressed her fingers against the gash, 3 inches long, right along her lowest rib, and they came away with a dark paste that smelled like rust, and something sweeter underneath, like crushed clover. Somewhere above her, through layers of stone and packed earth, the Alpha King's War Council was deciding the fate of 6 border packs. She did not know this yet. She did not know that in 11 minutes she would begin to hum, and that the sound would change everything. But first, there was the matter of staying conscious. Alara counted the drips from the pipe that ran along the ceiling of her cell. The pipe was copper, ancient, furred with green corrosion, and it leaked at a joint every 4 seconds. She had counted 6,412 drips since they had thrown her in here. That was roughly 7 hours. Before the cell, there had been the cart, a wooden thing that stank of pig fat and old hay. And before the cart, there had been the clearing where her pack had finally finished what they had been trying to do for years. Not kill her. That would have been simpler, and perhaps kinder. They had sold her. Alpha Renfeld of the Ashgrove pack had traded her to a merchant convoy heading for the capital in exchange for 4 barrels of salted venison and a breeding mare. Elara had watched the transaction from where 2 pack warriors held her arms behind her back, her bare feet in the frost-stiff grass, wearing the same linen shift she had been wearing when they dragged her from the healing house at dawn. She had been bandaging old Maren's arthritic hands when they came. The strips of cloth were still wrapped around her own fingers, spotted with Maren's joint salve, which smelled of camphor and beeswax. She was the pack healer. Not because she had a wolf, not because she had any standing whatsoever, but because her mother had taught her in the years before the fever took her, and because no one else in Ashgrove wanted to do the tedious, unglamorous work of grinding yarrow root and stitching wounds and sitting up through the night with sick pups who cried for their mothers. Elara had been useful, until she was not. The wound in her side had come from Brennan, Alpha Renfeld's eldest son, who had caught her trying to take her mother's old medicine satchel from the healing house before they put her on the cart. He had backhanded her first, the heavy signet ring on his right hand, splitting the skin above her eyebrow. And then when she had bent to pick up the fallen satchel, he had drawn his belt knife and cut her. Not deep enough to kill, just deep enough to teach. She had left the satchel on the floor. She had left everything. The only thing she carried into the dungeon was the lullaby her mother used to sing, and it lived in her chest, underneath the pain, humming against her ribs like a second heartbeat. In the cell to her left, someone coughed, a wet, rattling sound that echoed off the stone. The dungeons beneath the Alpha King's fortress were not meant for prisoners like her. They were meant for enemy combatants, spies, the occasional rogue wolf who challenged the king's law. Elara could smell the other prisoners, faintly through the walls, sweat and illness and old urine, and the particular metallic sharpness of long-caged wolves whose animals had gone half feral from confinement. She had been placed here because the merchant convoy had been stopped at the capital gates, and the soldiers had found her documentation to be irregular, which was a polite way of saying that Renfeld's bill of sale had been written on the back of a feed receipt and bore no official pack seal. So, the dungeon, while someone sorted out whether she was cargo or criminal. She pressed her back against the wall and drew her knees up. The shift rode up her thighs, and the cold hit fresh skin, and she shivered hard enough that the wound cracked open again. A thin line of warmth ran down her side. She should have been terrified. Part of her was. But a larger part, the part that had spent 22 years being the lowest creature in a pack of 47 wolves, the Omega with no wolf, the girl who ate last and slept in the room behind the kitchen where the pipes rattled all night long. That part of her was simply tired, tired in the way that goes past bone and into something structural. Load-bearing tiredness. The coughing in the next cell stopped. The dripping continued. And in the silence between drips, Elara did what she always did when the world became too much. She began to hum. The melody was simple. 5 notes up, 3 notes down, a pause, then a phrase that climbed and fell like breath. Her mother had hummed it every night, sitting on the edge of Elara's pallet, her fingers working through Elara's hair, untangling the knots with the patient slowness of someone who believed that every knot was a small problem that deserved to be solved gently. The words were in the old tongue, the language of the first wolves, and Elara did not know all of them anymore. But the shape of the melody was in her body, the way her own name was in her body, inseparable from self. She hummed and the sound filled the cell, bouncing off stone, gathering in corners, and something strange happened. The quality of the air changed. Not warmer, not colder, but thicker, somehow, as if the music had weight, as if it were pressing against the walls and finding the cracks and seeping through. In the cell to her left, the coughing man went quiet. Elara did not notice. Her eyes were closed. The melody moved through her, and as it always did when she lost herself in it, the pain receded. Not gone, but distant, like a voice calling from across a field. Her mother's face appeared behind her eyelids. Dark hair, green eyes, the scar on her chin from a fall she never explained. The smell of dried lavender and wood smoke that seemed to live in her skin. Mama. The word formed in her throat but did not leave. The humming continued. Climbing now, reaching the part of the lullaby where the melody opened up into something vast and aching, something that felt too large for a simple good-night song. There was longing in it. There was the sound of a door closing for the last time. There was winter and distance and a love so enormous it had nowhere to go but into music. The sound traveled through the stone. 3 floors above the dungeon, in the War Council chamber, the Alpha King of the Northern Territories stopped mid-sentence. His name was Kael Voss, and he had been in the middle of telling his border commander exactly what would happen to the Thornfield Pack if they crossed the river boundary one more time. The sentence involved the word annihilate. He had been about to use it with precision, the way a surgeon uses a scalpel, because Kael did not waste words. And his council had learned that when he spoke softly, it was far more dangerous than when he raised his voice. But the word died on his tongue, because something was happening to his chest. It felt like a hook, not painful, not at first, but undeniable, a sensation of being caught, of something taking hold of the muscle and bone around his heart and pulling gently. Steadily, downward. His wolf surged forward. Kael had ruled the Northern Territories for 9 years. Since the age of 23, since his father's death in the border wars had forced him onto the throne with blood still drying on his hands, in those 9 years, his wolf had been a constant companion, disciplined, lethal. Responsive to his will. Like a weapon responds to the hand that holds it. His wolf did not surge. His wolf did not do anything without permission. Until now. Kael gripped the edge of the oak table. The wood groaned under his fingers. His council, 12 wolves who had survived wars and famines, and the particular terror of serving a king whose patience was measured in seconds, all went silent. My king? His second, Darius, a scarred man with a voice like gravel on iron, leaned forward. You look quiet. The single word landed in the room like a dropped blade. Darius closed his mouth. Kael tilted his head. He was listening, not with his ears, or not only with his ears. His wolf was listening, and his wolf was pulling him. And the sound was humming. Someone was humming. The melody was faint, filtered through stone and distance, and it should have been impossible to hear from 3 floors up, through solid rock and reinforced doors, and the ambient noise of a fortress that housed 300 soldiers. But he heard it the way he heard his own blood. It was inside him, and it smelled like crushed clover. Who is in the dungeons? His voice was flat, toneless, the kind of calm that preceded storms. Darius frowned. Standard holding, my king. 11 prisoners, 3 Thornfield scouts awaiting interrogation, a smuggler, 7 vagrants picked up at the gates. I would need to check the logs for now. The word carried the weight of an alpha command, the kind that pressed against the wolf in every person who heard it, demanding submission, demanding obedience, demanding now, now, now. Darius was on his feet before he finished flinching, but Kael did not wait for the logs. He stood, and the movement was so sudden that his chair, a heavy thing made of black oak and iron, scraped back 3 feet across the stone floor. He was tall, 6'4" in his boots, and built with the dense, layered muscle of a wolf who fought his own battles rather than delegating them. His hair was black, worn longer than military standard, and his eyes were the color of raw amber, bright against skin, weathered by wind and war. A scar ran from his left temple to the hinge of his jaw, a souvenir from a challenge fight he had ended in 19 seconds. He walked out of the war council without another word. The 12 remaining council members sat in the silence he left behind and wondered, collectively, whether they should be concerned or relieved. Darius grabbed the prisoner logs from the shelf by the door and ran to catch up with his king, his boots echoing through the corridor like a second, faster heartbeat. Kael took the stairs down, not the main staircase, which wound through the keep's central tower, but the service stairs, the narrow stone passage used by servants and guards, because it was more direct. His boots hit each step with a controlled force that sent small showers of dust from the ceiling. His wolf was pacing inside him, back and forth, with a frenzy that Kael had never felt from the animal. Mate. The word formed in the space between human thought and animal instinct. Kael's jaw tightened. He had been waiting. 9 years on the throne without a Luna, without a chosen partner, without even the pretense of looking, because his wolf had been adamant from the beginning. The mate bond would come or it would not. His wolf would accept no substitute. And now his wolf was trying to claw through his skin to reach a sound coming from the dungeon. He hit the first sublevel. The air changed immediately, colder, damper. Carrying the mineral smell of deep stone and the acrid undertone of the oil lanterns that lined the corridor at 20-foot intervals. A guard stationed at the landing straightened so fast his helmet struck the wall behind him. My king, I... Open the gate. The guard fumbled with his keys. The iron gate swung open with a shriek of hinges. Kael stepped through into the first corridor of cells and the humming grew louder. The effect on him was physical. His pupils dilated. His heartbeat, normally a slow and controlled 60 beats per minute, even in combat, kicked up to something faster and less disciplined. His skin prickled with a warmth that seemed to radiate from the inside, as if his blood had been replaced with something lit. He stopped at the first cell. Inside, a man with matted hair and hollow cheeks looked up at him with wide, terrified eyes. Not her. Kael moved on. Second cell. Empty. Third cell. A woman with a Thornfield accent, who pressed herself against the far wall, and would not meet his eyes. Not her. The humming was coming from deeper in, from the lower corridor, the oldest part of the dungeon, where the cells were cut directly into the bedrock. Darius caught up with him at the top of the second staircase, breathless, the prisoner log open in his hands. My king, I have the manifest. Cells 1 through 8 are Thornfield combatants. Cell 9 is the smuggler. Cell 10 is empty. Cell 11 is... He squinted at the page. A female Omega. No wolf detected. Transferred from a merchant convoy. Irregular documentation. Pending review. A female Omega with no wolf, thrown into the deepest cell of his dungeon like refuse, while his war council debated territory lines and his kitchens prepared a feast he would not eat. Kael descended the second staircase, and the humming surrounded him. It was the most beautiful thing he had ever heard. Not beautiful in the way court musicians were beautiful, with their trained voices and careful harmonies. Beautiful in the way that a wound is beautiful when you understand what caused it. The melody carried grief and love in equal measure, braided together so tightly that one could not exist without the other. And it resonated in a part of Kael that he kept locked, had kept locked for 9 years. The part where his mother's death and his father's death and all the deaths since then lived in a pile that he never examined. His wolf howled inside him, silently, but with a force that made his vision blur. He reached the lower corridor, 6 cells, 3 on each side, lit by a single lantern that guttered in a draft from somewhere deeper underground. The humming was coming from the last cell on the right. Keys! Darius produced the master ring. Kael took it from his hand without looking at him. He walked to the last cell. The door was solid iron with a viewing slot at eye height and a lock that had not been oiled in years. He could smell her through the door. Clover. Rain on warm earth. And underneath, blood. Fresh blood. His wolf slammed against his control with a force that made his hand shake as he fitted the key into the lock. The lock turned, the door swung inward, and he saw her. She was on the floor, against the far wall, knees drawn up, arms wrapped around herself, eyes closed. Her shift was thin and dirty, and stained dark along the left side where something had bled through. Her hair was long and tangled, a color between brown and gold that the single lantern turned amber. Her feet were bare, her fingers were wrapped in strips of cloth, spotted with something that smelled like camphor. She was still humming, eyes still closed. She had not heard the door. Or rather, she had gone so deep into the song that the door did not matter. The music was the only place she had left to go, and she was there, all the way inside it. Kael stood in the doorway and could not move, because the mate bond hit him like a wall of water. Not gradually, not gently, not with the romantic subtlety that the old stories described. It hit him all at once, a full-body recognition that rewrote the priorities of every cell in his body, in the space of a single heartbeat. his wolf stopped pacing, stopped howling, and went completely, perfectly still. The way a predator goes still when it has finally found what it has been hunting. Mine. The word was not a thought. It was a fact. Like gravity. Like the turning of the earth. She opened her eyes. They were green. Not the dark green of forest canopy or the blue green of shallow water, but the clear, startling green of new growth, of the first leaves that push through snow in early spring. And they were enormous in her thin face. And they were looking at him with a fear so naked and absolute that it made something in his chest crack. The humming stopped. The silence was louder than the song. She stared at him, this enormous man filling the doorway, blocking what little light came from the corridor. And she pressed herself harder against the wall, and Kael watched her body try to become smaller. And his wolf made a sound inside him that was not a growl and not a whine, but something in between. Something that meant, "Do not be afraid of me. I will never hurt you. You are mine, and I am yours. And I have been looking for you for 9 years." "Who did this to you?" His voice came out wrong. He had intended it as a question. It came out as a statement, a declaration, a promise of violence directed at someone whose name he did not yet know, but whose death he had already decided. She did not answer. She was shaking. Her fingers gripped her knees, and her body trembled with a rhythmic, uncontrollable intensity that Kael recognized as a combination of cold, blood loss, and fear. He knelt. The action was so foreign to him, so antithetical to every instinct of an alpha king whose wolves had never seen him lower himself for anyone, that Darius, watching from the corridor, took an involuntary step backward. Kael knelt on the cold stone floor of the dungeon cell, bringing his eyes level with hers, and he said, in a voice that even he did not recognize, "I am going to come closer. I will not touch you until you say I can. Tell me your name." The green eyes blinked, her cracked lips parted. "Elara." The word came out in a whisper, a rasp, the voice of someone who had not spoken in hours, who had used her voice only for humming, for the song that had brought a king to his knees. "Elara." He said her name the way you say a word, in a language you are hearing for the first time, slowly, tasting it. "You are bleeding." She looked down at her side, as if she had forgotten. "It is not deep. It is not deep, but it has not been treated, and you are shaking." He did not move closer. He stayed on his knees, 3 feet from her, his hands resting on his thighs, where she could see them. "I am Kael. I am the alpha of this territory. You are in my dungeon, and you should not be. I was told my papers were wrong." Her voice was steadier now, but barely. "The merchant who transported me, he had a receipt from my former alpha. I was sold." The word "sold" landed in the cell like a stone dropped into still water. Kael felt his wolf push forward, pressing against his skin, and his eyes flickered, the amber brightening to something almost luminous. Behind him, Darius shifted his weight. "Sold." Kael repeated the word without inflection. "By whom?" "Alpha Renfeld, Ashgrove Pack." She said it flatly, the way you state a fact you have long since stopped being angry about. And that flatness was worse than tears, worse than rage, because it meant she had accepted it. She had accepted being sold like livestock, and the acceptance sat in her voice like sediment at the bottom of a river. Kael filed the name. Renfeld, Ashgrove. He would deal with that later. Right now, The woman in front of him was bleeding and cold and terrified, and his wolf was making it very difficult to think about anything other than wrapping his body around hers and not letting go for several decades. Darius, he did not turn around. Send for Mira. Tell her to bring a healing kit, warm blankets, broth, a change of clothes. He paused. And clear the queen's chambers. The silence behind him had a texture. It was the silence of a man who had served his king for 9 years and thought he understood him, and was now realizing he did not. The queen's chambers, my king? Did I stutter? No, my king. Darius left. His boots on the stairs sounded like retreat. Elara was staring at Kael with an expression he could not immediately read. Not fear anymore, or not only fear. Confusion. And underneath the confusion, the faintest flicker of something that looked like the ghost of hope, immediately strangled, because hope was a luxury she had trained herself not to afford. I don't understand, she said. You will. He held her gaze. Can I look at the wound? She hesitated. Then, with the careful deliberation of someone who has learned that every act of trust is a potential trap, she shifted her arm away from her side. The linen shift stuck to the skin where the blood had dried, and when she peeled it back, Kael saw the cut. 3 inches, clean edges, made by a sharp blade, not a claw. Someone had cut her with a knife. His wolf snarled, and Kael's eyes went full gold, and for a moment, the temperature in the cell seemed to change, a pulse of heat radiating from him like a furnace door swinging open. Elara flinched. He closed his eyes, breathed, pulled his wolf back, which was like pulling back a tide, and when he opened his eyes, they were amber again, controlled again. A knife, he said. Yes. Who? It does not matter. It matters. His voice was quiet, but carried the density of a vow. It matters, because whoever held that knife will answer for it. Not to you. To me. She looked at him then, really looked, and whatever she saw in his face made her breathing change. The rigid, shallow breathing of fear deepened into something slower. Not trust. Not yet. But the absence of the expectation of immediate harm, which for someone like Elara was as close to trust as she could get. Mira arrived 12 minutes later, a wolf in her 50s with grey-streaked hair pulled back in a practical bun and hands that smelled of antiseptic and honey. She was the fortress healer, and she had served Kael's father before him, and she did not ask questions when she entered a dungeon cell and found her king kneeling on the floor next to a bleeding Omega girl. She simply knelt beside them, opened her kit, and got to work. Kael watched her clean the wound. He watched Elara's face as the antiseptic touched raw flesh. She did not cry out. She did not even flinch. She simply closed her eyes and bit the inside of her cheek, and Kael could smell the tiny bloom of fresh blood in her mouth where her teeth broke skin, and his wolf howled again, silently, endlessly. The cut is clean, Mira said, threading a curved needle with catgut. 3 stitches. She is dehydrated and malnourished. Has she eaten? Kael looked at Elara. When did you last eat? She thought about it. Yesterday morning. There was bread on the cart. What kind of bread? She blinked at the question. Rye, I think. It was stale. There was mold on one side. I tore that part off. Kael stood up. The motion was sudden enough that Mira paused mid-stitch. Finish the stitches. Wrap the wound. Give her water. I will return in 10 minutes. He looked at Elara. I'm coming back. Do you understand? I am coming back, she nodded once, and he left the cell with a stride that ate ground. And when he reached the kitchen 4 minutes later, the head cook, a barrel-chested man named Aldrich, who had been roasting a haunch of venison for the evening meal, took one look at the king's face and stopped what he was doing entirely. Broth, Kael said. Bone broth. Hot. Not scalding. With bread that is fresh. Do you understand me? Fresh. Baked today. And if there is nothing baked today, then you will bake something now. Honey. Butter. Clean water with mint. On a tray. In the lower dungeon in 8 minutes. Aldrich had been cooking for the fortress for 20 years. He had never received a food order from the king personally. He had certainly never received one delivered with the specific intensity of a man who would set the kitchen on fire if the bread was stale. He nodded and started moving. Kael returned to the cell in 9 minutes. Mira had finished the stitches, wrapped the wound in clean linen, and was holding a cup of water to Alara's lips. Alara's color was marginally better. The blanket Darius had sent down was draped over her shoulders, rough wool, military issue, but warm. The tray arrived 1 minute after Kael. A young kitchen assistant carried it down the stairs with the exaggerated care of someone transporting nitroglycerin, set it on the floor of the cell, and fled. Kael picked up the bowl of broth. It was warm in his hands, golden, with small beads of fat floating on the surface and the deep mineral smell of marrow. He held it out to Elara. She looked at the bowl, then at him, then at the bowl again, and her eyes filled. Not with grief, with the particular overwhelm of someone for whom a simple act of care is so foreign that it short-circuits every defense mechanism they have built. She was not crying about the broth. She was crying about what the broth meant, which was that someone had noticed she was hungry and had done something about it, and that had not happened to her since her mother died 11 years ago. She took the bowl in both hands. Her fingers overlapped his for a moment, and the contact sent a current through both of them, visible in the way they both went still. Visible in the way Kael's breath caught and Alara's tears stopped mid-track, as if the world had paused to note that something irreversible had just occurred. She drank the broth in slow, careful sips. Kael sat across from her, his back against the opposite wall, his long legs bent because the cell was not built for men his size. And he watched her eat with the focused attention he normally reserved for battle plans and border treaties. The song you were singing, he said, after she had finished the broth and started on the bread, tearing it into small pieces and eating each piece separately, the habit of someone accustomed to making small amounts of food last. What was it? A lullaby. My mother sang it to me. She paused. A piece of bread halfway to her mouth. You heard it? I heard it from the War Council chamber. 3 floors up. She frowned. That is not possible. No, it is not. They looked at each other. Something passed between them that was not yet understood by either of them. A recognition that the impossible had happened and that neither of them was equipped to explain it. Your mother, Kael said. She was a wolf? She was. A healer. She died when I was 11. The fever. Elara set down the bread. She never told me what pack she came from. She arrived at Ashgrove before I was born, alone, carrying nothing. Alpha Renfeld's father took her in because she was useful. She could heal things that other healers could not. And you? I have no wolf. I was the Omega. The lowest rank. She said it without self-pity, the way you state your height or your eye color. My mother taught me to heal with herbs and touch. Sometimes when I focused, injuries would close faster than they should. but I have no wolf, no shift, no strength. Kyle's wolf stirred inside him with a complicated emotion that Kyle could not immediately pass. It was not pity. It was not desire, not only desire. It was recognition. The animal knew something that the man did not yet understand. "You will come upstairs with me," Kyle said. It was not a request. "I am a prisoner." "You were never a prisoner. You were mishandled by my gate soldiers, who will be disciplined and placed in a cell that should have been checked by my dungeon master, who will be replaced. You are not a prisoner. You are..." He stopped. He almost said it. The word was right there, pressing against the back of his teeth. "Mate. Mine." The beginning and end of every sentence his wolf had tried to form since he heard her humming through three floors of stone. But he looked at her, at the thin face and the bandaged wound, and the eyes that were still more afraid than hopeful. And he knew that the word would mean nothing to her if he said it now. Worse, it might frighten her. She did not know the bond. She could not feel it, or she could not identify what she felt, because she had no wolf to interpret it for her. So he stopped and said instead, "You are a guest." She studied him for a long moment. Her green eyes moved across his face with a careful assessing intelligence that he found, to his surprise, more compelling than any battle or negotiation or challenge fight he had ever experienced. "Guests usually arrive through the front door," she said. Something happened to his face, a crack in the stone. It took him a moment to realize it was a smile, small, brief, the first in a long time. "Then we will remedy that." He stood and offered her his hand. She looked at it. Large, calloused, scarred across the knuckles. A hand that had broken bones and signed death warrants and held a kingdom together through 9 years of war. It was steady. It did not tremble. She took it. His fingers closed around hers, and the world tilted, a subtle recalibration of gravity, as if the universe had adjusted to accommodate the fact that these two hands were now touching. He pulled her gently to her feet, and she swayed, and he caught her elbow, and she was close enough now that he could smell not just the clover and the blood, but her, the underneath scent, the one that lived in her skin. And it was wildflowers and rain and something warm he could not name. And his wolf went absolutely still with a reverence that bordered on worship. She was small next to him. The top of her head reached his collarbone. She looked up at him with those green eyes, and he looked down at her with his amber ones. And Darius, who had returned to the corridor and was watching from a respectful distance, thought, "Oh, so this is what it looks like." They went upstairs. The fortress reacted to her presence the way a hive reacts to a new queen, with confusion, curiosity, and the slow dawning of something that might be loyalty, or might be resentment, or might be both. Soldiers in the corridors stepped aside for their king, and stared at the small, barefoot woman walking beside him with a wool blanket wrapped around her shoulders and bandages on her fingers. Servants whispered. Word traveled through the keep with the speed and accuracy of fire. The king brought a girl out of the dungeon. "She is an Omega. No wolf." He had them prepare the queen's chambers. The queen's chambers had been empty for 23 years, since Kael's mother died giving birth to his stillborn sister. The rooms were on the east side of the keep, with windows that caught the morning sun, and they had been maintained but not lived in, kept clean by servants who dusted the furniture and aired the linens every month but treated the space with the reverent hush of a shrine. The bed was enormous, a four-poster draped in blue velvet, and the fireplace was large enough to stand in, and there was a bathroom with a copper tub deep enough to submerge in, and a window of colored glass that threw patterns of blue and gold across the floor when the light was right. Kael brought Alara to the door and stopped. "These are your rooms. Whatever you need, you ask. Food, clothing, anything. The door locks from the inside. Only from the inside. Do you understand what that means?" She looked at the room, then at him, and he could see the calculation happening behind her eyes, the survival math that someone like her ran constantly, weighing kindness against its probable cost, measuring the distance between a gift and a trap. "Why?" she asked. Just the one word. "Because you were humming your mother's lullaby in my dungeon, and I heard it through 3 floors of stone, and my wolf has been looking for you for 9 years, and I have learned, in that time, that some things do not need to be understood before they are acted upon." He said it plainly, without drama, the way you state coordinates or tactical positions. "I am not asking you for anything. I am telling you that you are safe. That is all." She stepped into the room. He did not follow. She turned and looked at him from the other side of the threshold. "Thank you," she said, and closed the door. He heard the lock turn. He stood in the corridor for 11 seconds, listening to the sound of her footsteps crossing the floor, and then he turned and walked to his own chambers, and Darius, who had been trailing at a distance, watched the king close his door and heard, through the thick oak, a sound he had never heard before. The Alpha King laughed. It was quiet, brief, slightly bewildered, the laugh of a man who has been hit by something he did not see coming and is not sure whether it is wonderful or catastrophic and suspects it might be both. 3 days passed. Alara did not leave the queen's chambers for the first day and a half. She slept. She slept the way the starving eat, with desperate, glutinous excess, her body seizing the opportunity for rest the way a drowning person seizes air. She slept in the enormous bed under blue velvet covers and woke only when servants knocked to deliver food, which arrived 3 times a day on trays covered with white linen. And each meal was more food than she had eaten in a week at Ashgrove. On the second morning, she bathed. The copper tub was filled with hot water that smelled of sage and chamomile, and she lowered herself in, and the heat hit the stitches in her side, and she hissed and then relaxed, and the water turned faintly pink and then clear again, and she sat in it until her fingers pruned and the light through the colored glass shifted from blue to gold. She found clothes laid out for her. Not the rough linen of a servant or the cast-offs of a pack omega, but actual clothes, soft wool trousers, and a tunic of sage green that fit her body as if someone had taken her measurements while she slept, which, she realized, someone probably had. There were boots, too. Soft leather, lined with fur. She put them on and stood in front of the mirror and did not recognize herself. Not because she had been transformed into a beauty. The scar above her eyebrow was still there, livid against her pale skin. Her cheekbones were too sharp, the architecture of hunger still visible beneath the surface. Her collarbones stood out like shelves, but she was clean and dressed and fed, and the woman in the mirror looked like someone who might, with time and care, become a person rather than a shadow. On the third morning, Kael knocked on her door. She opened it and found him standing in the corridor with 2 cups of tea, holding them with the careful awkwardness of a man whose hands were designed for swords and who was not entirely certain how to manage ceramic. He was wearing a simple black tunic, no crown, no ceremonial armor. And in the morning light, she could see the details she had missed in the dungeon's dimness, The scar from temple to jaw was old and silver. His eyes were lighter than she remembered. Amber shot through with gold like sunlight through resin. He smelled like thorn and something smoky, like embers from a banked fire. "I brought tea," he said, as if this required announcement. "I can see that. It is chamomile." "Thank you." He handed her a cup. Their fingers touched again. The current again. She pulled her hand back quickly, not from fear this time, but from the unfamiliarity of the sensation, the warmth that radiated from the point of contact and spread through her hand and up her arm and settled somewhere behind her sternum. "I would like to show you the healing house," he said, "if you are willing. Mira tells me you asked her about her supplies while she was stitching you." Alara had, in fact, spent 10 minutes questioning Mira about her herb stocks, her drying methods, and whether she was aware that her yarrow tincture was too dilute to be effective, a conversation that Mira had later described to Kyle as both informative and mildly insulting. They walked through the keep. Kyle adjusted his stride to match hers, which meant walking at roughly half his normal pace, and Alara noticed this and said nothing. And he noticed her noticing and also said nothing. And this was the beginning of a language between them that had nothing to do with words. The healing house was a long stone building attached to the keep's east wing, with high windows for light and workbenches scarred by years of use. Shelves lined three walls, holding jars and bottles and bundles of dried herbs, and the smell was complex and layered, camphor and calendula, and the sweet medicinal bite of willow bark. Mira was there, grinding something in a mortar, and she looked up when they entered and nodded as if she had expected this. "Show me the fever few," Alara said, before Kyle could introduce her properly. She had already moved to the shelves and was examining labels with the focused intensity of a scholar in a library. "You said yesterday that you were running low, and your comfrey poultices, they are too thick, they will not absorb properly. You need to add a carrier oil, something thin, walnut or almond." Mera looked at Kyle. Kyle looked at Alara. Alara was already pulling jars from the shelf and sniffing them with an expression of professional disapproval. "Your golden seal has gone stale," she said. "When was this harvested?" "Autumn," Mira said. "Last year." "It smells like last decade. Where do you source it?" "I need fresh root, not dried, and a workspace, and access to your garden, if you have one." "We have one," Mira said slowly. "It is behind the east wall." "Good. I will start there tomorrow. Is there anything urgent? Any sick? Any wounded?" Mira looked at Kyle again. Kyle was leaning against the doorframe with his arms crossed, and his expression was one that Mira had never seen on him before. It was the expression of a man watching something he values being exactly what he knew it was. "We have a soldier with a leg wound that will not close," Mira said. "Infection. 2 weeks now. I have tried everything I know." "Show me." They went to the soldier's bedside. He was a young wolf, 19 or 20, with a fever-bright face and a bandaged left leg that smelled, even through the wrappings, of rot and copper. Alara unwound the bandage with steady hands and looked at the wound, a deep gash across the shin where the flesh had gone purple at the edges, and wept a thin, foul-smelling fluid. "How was this caused?" she asked. "Silver-tipped arrow," the soldier said, through gritted teeth. Alara went still. Her fingers hovered over the wound. Then slowly, she placed her palm flat against the skin beside the infected area, and she closed her eyes, and the room changed. Not dramatically. Not with light or sound or any of the theatrical effects that healers in stories were supposed to produce. The air simply thickened. the way it had thickened in the dungeon cell when she hummed, and there was a faint vibration, barely perceptible, like a tuning fork held against a table, and underneath her palm, the flesh shifted. The soldier gasped. Mira leaned forward. Kael pushed off the doorframe. The purple faded. The edges of the wound, which had been ragged and necrotic, smoothed and pinked. The fluid stopped weeping. It happened over the course of 30 seconds, and when Alara lifted her hand, the wound was still open, but it was clean. The infection drawn out as if by a siphon, the flesh ready to heal on its own. Alara opened her eyes. She was pale. There was a fine tremor in her hands. Dress it with fresh comfrey and calendula. Change it twice a day. He will keep the leg. The soldier stared at his shin. How? My mother taught me. The standard answer. The one she had been giving her entire life. But it was not the whole answer, and everyone in the room knew it. Kael was looking at her with an expression that combined several incompatible emotions, wonder and recognition, and a possessive fury at the thought that this woman, this healer, this miracle, had been sold for venison and a horse. They left the healing house. In the corridor, Kael stopped and turned to her. That was not herbs, he said. No. Do you know what it was? My mother called it the gift. She had it. She said her mother had it before her. She said, Alara hesitated. The words she had never spoken aloud pressed against her teeth. She said it was in the blood. Our blood. She said we were descended from a line that was older than the packs, older than the hierarchy. A line that served the moon directly. I do not know what that means. I never did. Kael was quiet for a long time. Then he said, The moon blessed bloodline, the healers of Selene. She looked at him sharply. You know of it? My grandfather told me stories. A bloodline so old it predates the pack structure. Wolves who carried the moon's own healing gift. They were hunted centuries ago by alphas who feared what they could not control. The line was thought to be extinct. He looked at her with those amber eyes, and the weight of his gaze was almost physical. It is not extinct. She took a step back. I am not. I am nobody. An omega. No wolf. I cannot shift. I cannot. You healed silver-poisoned flesh with your bare hands. That does not make me. It makes you exactly what you are. His voice dropped, not in volume, but in register, into the range where it resonated in the chest rather than the ears. And what you are is something no one should have been allowed to sell. The air between them charged. That current again, stronger now, a magnetic pull that seemed to bend the space between their bodies. Elara's heart was beating too fast, and she could feel it in her throat, and she could smell him, pine and smoke, and something underneath that was just him, just Kael, and it made her dizzy. She stepped back again. I should rest. The healing, it takes something out of me. He let her go. He let her walk back to the queen's chambers and close the door and lock it. And he stood in the corridor and breathed and did not follow. And the restraint cost him something visible. A tightening of his jaw, a flex of his hands. The physical evidence of a man holding himself back from something every part of him wanted to do. The next 7 days established a pattern. Alara worked in the healing house. She reorganized Mera's herb stores, replanted the garden, treated 11 patients, including a pup with a respiratory infection that she cured by holding the child on her lap and humming until the congestion broke. The pup fell asleep against her chest, small fist curled in her tunic, and Alara held her with a tenderness that made Mira, who had raised 4 children of her own, look away, because the raw longing on the young woman's face was too private to witness. Kael appeared in the healing house every day. He brought reports and pretended to read them while watching Alara work. He asked her questions about herbs and poultices, and she answered with the detailed specificity of an expert who had been waiting years for someone to actually care about the answers. He told her about the border conflicts, the political tangles, the 7 packs under his rule, and the 3 that contested it. She listened with an attention that surprised him. She asked sharp questions. She understood power dynamics in a way that suggested she had spent years observing them from the bottom. On the 4th day, she asked him about his wolf. They were in the garden, Alara on her knees in the soil, dividing root clumps of feverfew, Kael sitting on the stone wall with an informality that his court would not have believed. She had dirt on her cheek and under her fingernails, and she looked more alive than she had since he found her in the cell. "Your wolf," she said, not looking up. "When you came to the dungeon, your eyes changed. I saw it. He reacted to you." "Why?" The question hung in the herb-scented air between them. Kael looked at her, at the crown of her head where her hair parted, the line of scalp white and vulnerable. "You know why," he said. She stopped dividing the root. Her hands went still in the dirt. "The mate bond?" "Yes. I cannot feel it. I have no wolf." "Your wolf is not absent. She is sleeping. Something suppressed her, probably when you were very young. The gift, the healing power, it may have taken the energy that would have gone to your wolf. Or someone suppressed it deliberately. Your mother, perhaps, to protect you." Alara sat back on her heels. Her hands were trembling again, not from exertion this time. "If she suppressed it, there might have been a reason. There might have been, and we will find out. But the bond exists whether you can feel it through a wolf or not. You feel it in other ways. The warmth when we touch. The way you sleep better knowing I am in the building. The way your heart rate changes when I enter a room." She looked up at him sharply. "You can hear my heart rate?" "I can hear your heart rate from the other side of the keep." A flush crept up her neck. She looked away. "That is deeply unfair. Most things about me are deeply unfair. I am very large and very powerful, and I have an army. Fair was never part of the arrangement." She stared at him, and then for the first time since the dungeon, she laughed. It was small, startled out of her, and she covered her mouth with a dirt-stained hand as if catching the sound before it escaped. But it was too late. He heard it, and the sound rearranged something in him that had been out of place for a very long time. "Come to dinner tonight," he said, "in the hall, with me." The laughter died. "Your people will not want an omega at their king's table. My people will want whatever I tell them to want. That is not how it works. It is exactly how it works. I am the Alpha King. The definition of how things work is whatever I say it is." He held her gaze. "Come to dinner, Lara." She came to dinner. The great hall was an enormous stone cavern with a ceiling lost in shadow and long trestle tables where the fortress wolves ate together every evening. 300 seats, most of them full, and the noise when Alara entered was a wall of sound, voices and laughter, and the clatter of crockery and the underlying bass note of wolves in close quarters, the constant subliminal rumble of animals coexisting. Kael walked beside her. He had changed into formal black, a tunic with silver thread at the collar, and the crown was on his head, a simple band of dark metal that sat across his forehead like a blade. Alara wore a dress that Mira had helped her choose, deep green, the color of her eyes, and her hair was washed and brushed and fell in waves to the middle of her back. The scar above her eyebrow was visible. She had not tried to hide it. The hall went quiet. 300 wolves watched their king escort a small, scarred woman to the high table. They watched him pull out the chair to the right of his own, the Luna's chair, empty for 23 years, and hold it for her while she sat. They watched him sit beside her and pour her wine from his own flask, a gesture that, in wolf tradition, meant more than it looked, because an Alpha's flask was his personal possession, and sharing it was an act of profound intimacy. The whispers started before the first course was served. Kael ignored them with the serene indifference of a man who could kill everyone in the room and was choosing not to. Elara, who could not kill everyone in the room and was very aware of it, kept her eyes on her plate and her hands in her lap and tried not to calculate how many exits the hall had. It was the woman across the table who broke the tension. Her name was Selene, and she was the daughter of the Lord of the Ironwood Pack, one of the seven packs under Kael's rule. She was tall, beautiful in the sharp-boned way of high-born wolves, with black hair and dark eyes, and the particular confidence of someone who had been told since birth that she was destined for greatness. She had been at the capital for 6 weeks, a guest of the court, and her father had made no secret of his hope that she would catch the Alpha King's eye. Selene looked at Elara, looked at the Luna's chair, looked at the wine flask, and her face went through several transformations in rapid succession, surprise to disbelief, to fury, to something cold and settled and dangerous. "My king," her voice carried. She wanted it to carry. "I see you have found entertainment. Will the Omega be serving the table or sitting at it?" The hall went from quiet to silent, the kind of silent that precedes violence. Kael did not look at Selene. He was cutting his meat with precise, unhurried movements. "She is sitting at it," he said to his plate, "as you can see. In the Luna's chair, as you can see. The Luna's chair is traditionally reserved for the woman I place in it." He looked up. His eyes were not amber. They were gold, full gold, wolf gold, and the dominance that rolled off him was a physical thing, a pressure wave that pushed against every wolf in the room and made them want to bare their throats. Selene's wolf responded before her mind could override it, and she dropped her eyes involuntarily, and the humiliation of that involuntary submission colored her cheeks dark red. "Do you have any other observations about tradition, Lady Selene? I am always eager to learn." She did not speak again for the rest of the meal, but she watched Elara with an intensity that had nothing to do with curiosity and everything to do with the cold, patient mathematics of a rival assessing a threat. After dinner, Kael walked Elara back to her chambers. "She will be a problem," Elara said. It was not a question. "She will try to be. She will fail. You are very confident." "I am very accurate. There is a difference." He stopped at her door. "Elara, the bond. I will not push it. I will not claim you or mark you or make any demand. But I want you to know what you are to me, because you deserve to know, and because I have discovered that I am not capable of pretending otherwise." She looked up at him. In the torchlight, his face was all angles and shadow, and the scar gleamed silver, and his eyes were back to amber, warm and steady. "You are my mate," he said. "You are the other half of everything I am. My wolf recognized you the moment he heard your voice. I have waited 9 years, and I would have waited 9 more, and 9 after that, and I would have died waiting if that was what it took. But you are here now, and I am not going to pretend that this is casual, or temporary, or anything less than the most important thing that has ever happened to me. The words landed on her like weight. She felt them settle on her shoulders, on her chest, on the parts of her that had been empty for so long that she had forgotten they existed. She wanted to step forward. She wanted to press her face against his chest and feel his arms close around her and stop being afraid for 1 minute, just 1 minute. Instead, she said, "I need time." "You have it." She went inside. She locked the door. She sat on the enormous bed in the Queen's chambers and pressed her hands against her face and felt, underneath the fear and the confusion and the careful, practiced skepticism, the first green shoots of something she had not felt in 11 years. "Time," she had said. He had given it to her. But the world was not so generous. 3 days later, they came for her. It happened at night. Elara was in the healing house, late because a warrior had come in with a training injury, a dislocated shoulder that she had reduced and wrapped. She was washing her hands in the basin when she heard footsteps that were too quick and too deliberate to be casual. 3 people entered the healing house. 2 men she did not recognize, large, wearing unmarked leather armor, and Celine. Celine was dressed for travel. Dark clothing, boots, a cloak with the hood down. Her face was composed, but her eyes were bright with something that Elara recognized, having seen it before, in other faces, in other packs. The brightness of someone who has convinced themselves that cruelty is justice. "Lady Celine." Elara dried her hands on a cloth. Her voice was steady. Her heart was not. "It is late." "It is." Celine came closer. The 2 men flanked her. "Do you know who I am, Omega?" "I know who you are." "Then you know that my father rules the largest pack under the King's Alliance, that an alliance between Ironwood and the Crown would strengthen the Northern Territories beyond challenge, that I have been bred and trained and prepared for the role of Luna since I was old enough to walk. I know these things, and you, a wolfless Omega with no bloodline, no pack, and no standing, have been sitting in my chair." Elara set down the cloth. "It is not your chair." Celine's hand moved. Fast. She caught Elara by the wrist and squeezed, and her grip had wolf strength behind it, and the small bones in Elara's wrist ground together with a sound like pebbles shifting. "You are going to leave," Celine said. "Tonight. My men will escort you to the southern road. You will walk until you reach the next territory, and you will not come back. If you do, I will make certain that the king finds your body in a way that looks like an accident." The pain in Elara's wrist was sharp and clarifying. It cut through the fog of fear and found something underneath. Something hard and bright that she did not immediately recognize because it had been sleeping for a very long time. Anger. Not the small, manageable anger of someone accustomed to being mistreated. A deeper anger. A structural anger. The kind that lives in the foundations and, when awakened, reshapes everything built on top of it. "Let go of my wrist," Elara said. "Or what? You will heal me to death?" Something happened. Later, when the accounts were compared, no one could agree on the exact sequence. Mira, who had fallen asleep in her office and was woken by the noise, would say that she saw light. Celine's men would say they felt heat. Selina herself, in the days that followed, would say nothing at all, because what happened to her was not the kind of thing you discussed. Elara's eyes changed color. The clear green went white. The pure, blinding white of moonlight on fresh snow, and the air around her hands still gripped by Celine's fingers, began to vibrate with a frequency that made the glass jars on the shelves rattle, and the lanterns flicker, and the water in the washing basin ripple outward from a center point. Celina let go. Not voluntarily. Her fingers simply opened, unlocked by a force that was not physical, but was undeniable. And she stumbled backward, and her two men stumbled with her, and they hit the wall and stayed there. Not pinned. Not held. Just stopped. As if the air around them had solidified into something that did not want them to move. Elara stood in the center of the healing house, with white eyes and vibrating hands, and a power rolling off her in waves that Mira, from the doorway of her office, could feel in her teeth. Then as quickly as it started, it stopped. Elara's eyes went green again. Her hands went still. She swayed, caught herself on the workbench, and looked at her own palms as if they belonged to someone else.
What?
Celine's voice was a whisper. Her composure was gone. What was left underneath was something Elara had not expected to see. Celine was terrified, but not in a simple way. Her terror had a specific texture, and underneath it, visible for just a moment before she rebuilt her walls, was something that looked almost like grief. The grief of someone who has spent her entire life preparing for a role that was just taken from her by a power she cannot match, and who understands in this moment that everything she was told about her own destiny was a lie. It lasted 3 seconds. Then Celine's face closed like a door, and she turned and Wall walked out, and her men followed, and the healing house was quiet. Elara sank to the floor and pressed her forehead against the cold stone and breathed. Kael found her there 20 minutes later. He had felt it, the surge of power from his chambers on the other side of the keep, the same way he had heard her lullaby through 3 floors of stone. The bond conducted everything. He did not ask what happened. He looked at the jars knocked from shelves, the water on the floor, the scuff marks on the wall where Celine's men had been pushed. He looked at Elara on the floor, shaking. He knelt beside her. Elara, something is wrong with me. Nothing is wrong with you. My eyes turned white. I could feel it. I could feel everything. Every living thing in this room, every heartbeat, and I could have, but you did not. She looked at him. Her eyes were green again, but red-rimmed, and there were tears on her face that she seemed unaware of. What am I? You are moon-blessed, the last of the healers of Celine. Your mother hid it, hid you. Suppressed your wolf and your power to keep you safe. Because the last time the Pax knew your bloodline existed, they tried to destroy it. She never told me. She was protecting you. She was leaving me defenseless. The bitterness in her voice was the first truly angry thing he had heard her say, and it cracked something open between them, because the anger was not at her mother. Not really. It was at the world that had made her mother's choice necessary. It was at every pack that had hunted her bloodline. Every alpha who had feared what he could not control. Every system that looked at a girl with no wolf and saw only weakness, when underneath the weakness was something that could rattle glass and stop grown wolves in their tracks. Kyle reached out and took her hand. She did not pull away. He held it, said nothing, and they sat on the floor of the healing house in the silence between one world and the next. Celina will retaliate, Elara said. Celina will do what she does. I will deal with it. She is the daughter of your most powerful lord. She is the daughter of a lord who serves at my pleasure. His daughter's ambitions do not override the safety of my mate. He said the word deliberately, watching her face. She did not flinch from it this time. That night, Elara did not lock the door. Kael did not enter, but he sat on the floor outside her room, his back against the wall, and stayed there until dawn. He could hear her breathing through the door. He could hear the moment she fell asleep, the way her heartbeat slowed and deepened, and he could hear, in the deepest part of her sleep, the faint, nearly inaudible sound of humming. The lullaby, again, coming not from her conscious mind, but from somewhere deeper, from the place where her wolf was sleeping and her mother's songs were stored, and her power waited like a sea behind a dam. He sat and listened, and did not sleep, and his wolf lay quiet inside him, content for the first time in 9 years, because the sound of her breathing was, finally, enough. But the storm that was coming would not wait for readiness. It arrived 4 days later in the form of a delegation. Alpha Renfeld of the Ashgrove Pack rode through the fortress gates with 20 warriors and a letter bearing the seal of the Interpack Council. He was a thick-necked man with close-set eyes and a beard that did not quite hide the weakness of his chin, and he rode a grey stallion that was too large for him, which told you everything you needed to know about how he compensated. He had come for Elara. The letter stated that the Omega known as Elara, property of the Ashgrove Pack, had been illegally detained by the King's forces and was to be returned immediately to her rightful owner. The Interpack Council, citing Article 12 of the Territorial Compact, supported this claim. Kael read the letter in the throne room. The throne was carved from a single piece of obsidian, black and gleaming, and he sat in it the way a blade sits in its sheath, with a precision that suggested it had been made for him. Renfeld stood at the base of the dais, flanked by his warriors, and he was sweating, which was reasonable. Because the Alpha King's throne room had a reputation for being the last room certain people ever entered. "You sold a sentient wolf for livestock," Kael said. His voice was conversational. The conversational tone was the one his court feared most. "She is not a wolf," Renfeld said. "She has no shift. She is an Omega, unclaimed, with no pack standing. Under our charter, she is... Under your charter, she is a person. Under any charter, in any territory, in any interpretation of any law written by anyone who was not actively deranged, she is a person. You sold a person." Renfeld's jaw worked. "With respect, my king, the Omega is my pack's property. She was assigned to the healing house as a servant. She has no bloodline, no... She is of the moon-blessed line." The throne room went very quiet. Renfeld's face did something complicated. Surprise first, then disbelief, then a flicker of something that moved too fast to catch. Something that looked for just a moment like fear. Not fear of Kael, fear of the information itself. "That is impossible," he said. But his voice had changed. "Is it?" Kael leaned forward. "Her mother, the healer who arrived at your pack alone, before Elara was born, carrying nothing. You never questioned her origins?" Renfeld was silent for too long, and in that silence, Kael read the truth. "You knew," Kael said. "Not a question." "I did not." "You knew what her mother was. Your father took her in because her healing ability made your pack stronger. And when the mother died, you kept the daughter for the same reason. But you never told anyone what she was, because a moon-blessed healer is worth more as a secret than as a public asset. And when she became inconvenient, you sold her, because dead bloodlines cannot file complaints. Renfeld's face was the color of old wax. Behind him, his warriors shifted with the restless energy of wolves who were beginning to realize that their alpha had brought them into a situation from which there might not be a clean exit. "The Interpac Council will hear my claim," Renfeld said, but the words had no weight. "The Interpac Council will hear whatever I allow them to hear. I am the Alpha King, Renfeld. I do not answer to the Council. The Council answers to me." Kyle stood. The movement was slow, deliberate, and had the effect of a shadow growing across the floor. "You sold my mate for 4 barrels of venison and a breeding mare." The word "mate" detonated in the room like a charge. Renfeld took a step back. His warriors closed ranks behind him, an instinct, not a strategy, because no strategy was going to help them now. "Your mate?" Renfeld repeated. The word came out strangled. "My mate, my fated, the woman whose voice I heard through 3 floors of stone, the woman your son cut with a belt knife." Kyle's eyes went gold, not flickering, not transitioning, full solid gold, and the dominance that poured off him was not a wave, but a wall, an absolute assertion of power that pressed every wolf in the room toward the floor. Renfeld's knees buckled. He went down, not gracefully, not with dignity, his legs simply giving out under the weight of an alpha command that his wolf could not resist. His warriors followed, one by one, driven to their knees by a force that had nothing to do with physical strength and everything to do with the pure, undiluted authority of a king whose wolf had found its mate and was no longer interested in restraint. "Your son," Kyle said, looking down at the kneeling alpha. "Brennan, where is he?" He is at Ashgrove. He will be brought here. He will answer for the wound he inflicted. And you, Renfeld, will sign a document relinquishing all claim to Alara, acknowledging her status as a free wolf of the Northern Territories, and ceding your eastern timber rights to the Crown as reparation. The eastern timber rights are worth more than you paid for her, less than she is worth. Sign, or I will dissolve your pack charter and redistribute your territory among the remaining 6 packs. You have until sunset. Renfeld signed. He signed sitting on the floor of the throne room because his legs had not recovered enough to stand, and his hand shook, and the pen scratched across the parchment with the sound of a man's authority being amputated. But here was the thing about Renfeld that Kael noted and filed away. As the defeated Alpha was led from the throne room by his own warriors, he paused at the door, turned back, and for one brief moment, the bluster and the weakness and the cruelty all dropped away, and what was left was something smaller and older, something that looked almost like regret. "Her mother," Renfeld said. "She asked me to protect the girl when she was dying. She asked me, and I gave her my word." Kael did not move. "I failed," Renfeld said, and left. The word sat in the throne room like a stone in a river, water flowing around it, unchangeable. Kael looked at it for a long time. Then he went to find Ilara. She was in the garden, kneeling in the dirt, her hands in the soil, and she was humming. The lullaby. The same 5 notes up, 3 notes down. The pause, the climbing phrase. And the plants around her, the fever few and the comfrey and the calendula, and the small patch of golden seal she had planted 3 days ago, were growing. Visibly. The golden seal, which should have taken weeks to establish, was already sending up shoots, pale green against the dark soil, reaching toward her hands as if her fingers were the sun. She did not look up when he approached. She knew it was him. She always knew. "He came for me," she said.
"He did."
"And you sent him away?" "I did more than that. I took his timber rights and his pride and possibly his will to live. He signed the release. You are free." She was quiet for a moment. The golden seal continued to grow. "He knew about my mother." "Yes." "He promised her he would protect me. He told me." Her hands went still in the soil.
"He failed."
She said it the way Renfeld had said it, with the same flatness, but hers was the flatness of someone stating a wound rather than confessing one. "They all failed. My mother hid me and died. Renfeld hid me and sold me. Everyone who has ever known what I am has either tried to use it or tried to bury it." Kael knelt beside her in the garden, his knees pressed into the damp earth. The golden seal shoots bent toward him, then away, then toward Alara again, confused by the proximity of two powerful presences. "I am not going to bury it," he said, "and I am not going to use it. It is yours, your gift, your bloodline, your wolf when she wakes. I am offering you a place beside me, not because of what you are, but because my wolf chose you, and I trust my wolf more than I trust anything else in this world." She looked at him. Her green eyes were clear and steady and dry. "And if I choose to leave?" The question cost her something. He could see it in the tension of her jaw, the way her fingers curled in the soil. She did not want to leave. But she needed to know that she could. "Then I will watch you go, and I will spend the rest of my life listening for your voice in the walls." He said it simply, the way you state a fact you have accepted, even though it will destroy you. She held his gaze for a long time. Then she reached out, her hand earth-stained and trembling slightly, and placed it against his chest, over his heart. The mate bond responded. It surged through both of them, not the one-sided pull that Kael had been feeling, but a mutual recognition, a circuit completing. And Alara gasped because she felt it, truly felt it, for the first time. Not through a wolf, through herself, through the moon-blessed blood in her veins that did not need a wolf to recognize its other half. "Oh," she said. Just that. A small, startled syllable that contained an entire shift in understanding. "Yes," he said, and covered her hand with his. They stayed like that, kneeling in the garden, until the light changed and the shoots of golden seal grew 6 inches and the fortress carried on around them, oblivious to the fact that its king was on his knees in the dirt, with a wolfless Omega's hand over his heart, and something on his face that none of his soldiers or counselors or enemies had ever seen. Something that looked like peace. But peace in the Northern Territories was always borrowed. The attack came 11 days after Renfeld's departure. It did not come from Renfeld. It came from Lord Gavriel of the Ironwood Pack. Selina's father, the man whose daughter had been humiliated at the king's table and terrorized in the king's healing house, and who had returned home with a story that had been carefully, methodically altered. In Selene's version, the Omega had attacked her unprovoked. In Selene's version, the Omega was not moon-blessed, but something else, something dangerous and unstable, a weapon that the king had been bewitched into protecting. In Selene's version, the Northern Territories were in danger, and only decisive action could save them. Lord Gavriel believed his daughter, or more accurately, Lord Gavriel found his daughter's story useful, because it gave him a pretext to do what he had wanted to do for years, challenge Kael's authority and position himself as an alternative power. He came with 200 warriors. They crossed the border at dawn, moving fast through the pine forests that separated Ironwood territory from the capital region, and by the time Kael's border scouts detected them and sent word, they were 4 hours from the fortress. The news arrived while Kael was in the healing house, watching Alara teach Mira a new method for preparing silver-wound poultice. Darius brought it, breathless, the scout's report in his hand, and the look on his face told Kael everything before a word was spoken. Gavriel, 200, armed for siege, 4 hours out. Kael stood. The transformation was instant. The gentleman who had been watching his mate grind herbs was gone, replaced by the Alpha King, who had held the Northern Territories through 9 years of war and challenge. His eyes went cold. His voice went flat. His body, which had been relaxed, became something architectural, something load-bearing. Rally the garrison, full armor, defensive positions along the northern approach. Send runners to the Ashwood and Riverdale packs, call the Alliance levy, and get a message to Gavriel. What message, my king? Tell him to turn around, and if he does not, then tell him I said hello. Darius left at a run. Kael looked at Alara. She was standing by the workbench, poultice forgotten, and her face was pale, but her eyes were steady. This is about me, she said. This is about a lord who wants power. You are the excuse. He would have found another. But the excuse is me. If I left... If you left, I would follow you, and the territory would fall, and Gavriel would get what he wants. You are not leaving. That is not a command. That is a statement of what will happen if you try. He crossed to her and took her face in his hands, gently, his thumbs against her cheekbones, and for a moment his eyes were not cold, and his voice was not flat. They were amber and warm, and entirely for her. Stay. Stay in the fortress. Let me end this. She nodded. He kissed her forehead. Quick. Brief. The first time his lips had touched her skin, and the contact sent a jolt through both of them that was visible in the way their breath caught simultaneously. Then he was gone, and the fortress mobilized around her like a machine built for exactly this purpose. Alara did not stay in the healing house. She did not stay in the queen's chambers. She climbed to the east tower, the highest point of the fortress, and looked north, and in the distance, through the morning haze, she could see them. A dark line moving through the pines. 200 wolves. Coming for her. Her hands were shaking. Not with fear, though there was fear. With something else. The power that had surged in the healing house when Celine grabbed her wrist was stirring again. Deeper this time, a vibration that started in her chest and radiated outward through her blood. Her wolf stirred. Not woke. Not yet. But stirred. A movement in the deep, a shifting of something vast and dormant, like a creature turning in its sleep. Alara gripped the stone parapet and breathed and felt, for the first time, the outline of her own wolf pressing against the inside of her skin. She was there. She had always been there. Sleeping, suppressed, hidden by a mother who loved her enough to cripple her in order to save her. But the sleep was ending. Kael met Gavriel's force on the northern field, a flat expanse of ground between the forest edge and the fortress walls. He had 300 warriors behind him, plus the garrison, plus the beginning of the Alliance levy, riders from Ashwood and Riverdale who had answered the summons with the speed of wolves who knew what an Alpha King's call meant. Gavriel rode at the head of his force, a tall man with Celine's sharp bones and dark eyes, wearing ceremonial armor that was more impressive than practical. He stopped 50 yards from Kael's line and raised a gauntleted hand. "Alpha King," his voice carried across the field. "I come not as an enemy, but as a concerned lord of your realm. You come with 200 armed wolves crossing my border without permission." Kael's voice was flat, conversational, terrifying. In most interpretations, that is an enemy. "I come to petition for the safety of the Northern Territories. The creature you harbor in your fortress is..." "Choose your next word very carefully, Gavriel." The lord hesitated. Behind him, his warriors shifted. They were wolves who had trained for combat, but had never faced the Alpha King in the open. And the reality of his presence, the sheer physical weight of his dominance, was doing things to their confidence that their training had not prepared them for. "The Omega," Gavriel said. "She attacked my daughter." "Your daughter entered my healing house at night with 2 armed men and threatened my healer. Your daughter's account of the event differs from the account of my fortress healer, who witnessed it. And your daughter's actions constitute assault on a member of my household, which is a territorial offense. She is an Omega. She has no standing. She has my standing. She is my mate." The word rippled through Gavriel's force, the way news of earthquakes ripples through populations. Some wolves went still. Some shifted their weight. Some, the smart ones, began calculating the distance between where they stood and where they needed to be to survive. "You would bond with a wolfless Omega." Gavriel's voice carried a contempt that was genuine, and for a moment, Kael saw not a scheming lord, but a man whose worldview was genuinely incompatible with what was being presented to him. Gavriel believed in hierarchy. He believed that alphas mated with alphas, and that omegas existed to serve, and that the natural order was the only order. He was not scheming in this moment. He was horrified. It did not make him less dangerous, but it made him less simple. "I would bond with the woman my wolf chose," Kael said, "and I would strongly advise you to reconsider your position before I make you reconsider it." Gavriel drew his sword. The battle was not long. It was not supposed to be. Kael shifted. The Alpha King's wolf was a thing from the old stories, the kind of wolf that made other wolves remember that they were, underneath the civilization and the hierarchy and the politics, prey animals in the presence of an apex predator. He was massive, nearly 6 feet at the shoulder, with fur the color of midnight and eyes that burned gold in the morning light. He moved with a speed that should have been impossible for his size, crossing the 50 yards between the two forces in a time that Gavriel's warriors would later swear was less than 3 seconds. Gavriel's own wolf was large, alpha-blooded, powerful, bred for combat. It lasted 22 seconds. Kael did not kill him. He pinned him, massive jaws around the ironwood alpha's throat, gold eyes staring into dark ones. And the message was clear and ancient, and required no translation. "Submit or die. These are your options. There are no others." Gavriel submitted. His wolf went limp. His warriors, seeing their alpha with the king's jaws around his throat, dropped their weapons with a collective clatter that sounded like a building falling. It was over. Or it should have been. Celine came from the forest. She had not been with her father's force. She had circled around, through the trees, and while the battle drew everyone's attention northward, she entered the fortress from the south, through a service entrance that she had memorized during her 6 weeks as a court guest. Elara was in the east tower. She felt Selina before she heard her. The bond with Kael was singing with combat adrenaline, But underneath it, her own awakening senses detected something closer, something moving through the fortress with hostile intent. Celine appeared at the top of the tower stairs. She was carrying a silver dagger.
You should have left when I told you to, Celine said.
Her voice was calm. Too calm. The calm of someone who has crossed a line and knows there is no going back. Elara turned to face her. The wind from the tower parapet caught her hair. Below, the distant sounds of a battle ending, weapons being surrendered, wolves being herded into formations. Celine, it is over. Your father has submitted. My father is a fool who should have brought 1,000 wolves instead of 200. Celine stepped closer. The silver dagger caught the light. Do you know what silver does to moon-blessed blood? I do. I researched it after what you did to me in the healing house. Silver does not just wound you. It silences you. Permanently. Elara backed toward the parapet. The stone was cold against her spine. The drop behind her was 200 feet. You do not have to do this, Elara said. I have spent my entire life preparing for a throne that was promised to me. Every lesson, every training session, every night I spent learning protocol and politics and the precise angle to bow to visiting dignitaries. My father told me I was born for this. My mother told me. My entire pack told me. Celine's voice cracked, and underneath the crack was something raw and true. And then you came out of a dungeon, with no wolf and no bloodline and no training, and he looked at you the way I have wanted someone to look at me my entire life. The words hung in the tower air. And Elara, who had spent 22 years being the lowest creature in a pack of 47 wolves, who understood what it meant to be told you were one thing and discover you were another, felt something she did not expect. Compassion, not forgiveness, not absolution. Celina had threatened her, tried to have her removed, and was now standing in front of her with a silver dagger. Compassion did not mean capitulation. But Elara could see the wound underneath the weapon, and she could not pretend she did not. He does not look at me because of what I am, Elara said. He looks at me because of the bond. You could not have changed that. No amount of preparation could have changed that. I know. Celine's voice was a whisper. I know, and I hate you for it. She lunged. Elara's wolf woke up. It was not gradual, not a slow awakening, not a gentle uncurling. It was an eruption, a detonation, a dam breaking, and everything Elara's mother had suppressed for 22 years came flooding out in a single, blinding instant. Her eyes went white. Not the flickering white of the healing house. Pure, solid, lunar white. The color of the full moon reflected in still water. Her body, which had been small and thin and scarred, transformed, not into a wolf, not yet, but into something between, something that radiated light and heat, and a power so fundamental that the stone beneath her feet vibrated with it. The silver dagger reached her. It touched her skin. And it shattered. The metal fragments scattered across the tower floor like dropped coins, and Celine staggered back, her empty hand closing on nothing, and the light pouring from Elara intensified until it was visible from the field below, a column of white light rising from the east tower like a beacon. On the field, Kael lifted his head from Gavriel's throat and looked up at the tower, and his wolf howled. Not in fear, but in recognition, in exultation, because his mate's wolf was waking and the sound of it, the frequency of it, resonated in every cell of his body. 300 wolves on the field looked up. 200 surrendered Ironwood warriors looked up. Gavriel, still pinned, looked up, and they saw the East Tower wrapped in moonlight at 9 in the morning. And they knew, all of them, that something old and sacred and supposedly extinct was announcing itself to the world. Selene was on her knees, not from dominance, not from an alpha command, from awe. The power coming from Alara was not aggressive, not hostile, not the power of a king demanding submission. It was the power of the moon itself, the power that had created the first wolves, the power that the healers of Selene's bloodline had carried for centuries, and it asked for nothing and demanded nothing, and overwhelmed everything. Alara looked down at her hands. They were glowing, a soft, steady white that pulsed in time with her heartbeat, and inside her, behind her eyes, a presence she had never felt before. Her wolf. She was silver. Not metaphorically. The wolf that unfurled inside Alara's consciousness was the color of moonlight, luminous and strange and ancient, and she looked at Alara with green eyes, and Alara looked at her with green eyes, and the 22-year separation ended in a single, wordless moment of reunion. The light faded. Alara dropped to her knees, breathing hard, and the tower was just a tower again, and the morning was just a morning, and Selene was across from her, also on her knees, and they were both crying, for entirely different reasons, and in entirely the same way. Kael reached the tower in under 2 minutes. He took the stairs 4 at a time, still in wolf form, and shifted at the top, and he was barely dressed, just trousers pulled on in the transition. And he crossed the tower floor and dropped to his knees beside Alara and pulled her into his arms. She let him. She pressed her face against his bare chest and felt his heart hammering against her cheek and his arms around her, enormous, encompassing. And the mate bond between them was no longer a pull or a current, but a completed thing, a bridge with traffic flowing in both directions. And she could feel him the way she felt her own heartbeat, constant, essential, irreplaceable. "My wolf," she said, against his skin. "She is silver. Of course she is." His voice was rough and low and shaking slightly, and his arms tightened around her. "Of course she is." Behind them, Selene stood. She wiped her face with the back of her hand. She looked at the scattered fragments of the silver dagger on the floor. She looked at the king holding the Omega on the stone floor of the tower. And she turned and walked down the stairs, and no one stopped her. The marking ceremony took place 3 days later, under the full moon, in the great hall of the fortress. 300 wolves stood witness, delegations from the 7 packs, including Ironwood, whose new representative was a cousin of Gavriel's, because Gavriel himself had been stripped of his lordship and sent to the border outpost to serve as a common patrol wolf for the remainder of his days. It was, by Kael's standards, merciful. Gavriel's genuine belief in the hierarchy he served had bought him his life, if not his title. Selene was not punished. Kael had wanted to. His wolf had demanded it, but Alara had asked him not to, and when he demanded a reason, she said only she was mourning a future she had been promised. The grief was real, even if the response was wrong. He had stared at her for a long time. Then he had said, "You are going to be a very inconvenient Luna," and she had said, "Probably," and he had almost smiled. Selene was sent home to Ironwood under escort. She would live. She would carry the memory of silver light and the sound of ancient power. And whether that memory became wisdom or bitterness was a story for another time. Brennan, Renfeld's son, had been brought to the fortress in chains. He stood in the throne room on the morning of the ceremony, and Kael sentenced him to 3 years of labor in the fortress kitchens, where he would learn what it meant to serve rather than be served, and where Aldric the head cook would, with great enthusiasm, make his life extremely educational. The ceremony itself was simple. Full moon, great hall, 300 wolves. Elara wore white. Not a gown, not a confection. A simple white dress, sleeveless, that left her arms bare, and the scars were visible. The one above her eyebrow from Brennan's ring, and the one on her side from Brennan's knife, and others, smaller, older, a map of 22 years of being the lowest creature in a pack of 47 wolves. She did not hide them. Kael wore black. The crown sat on his brow. His amber eyes never left her face. The tradition was ancient. The alpha marked his mate, a bite on the curve between neck and shoulder, his teeth breaking skin, his wolf's bond becoming permanent, irrevocable, a claim that could not be undone by law or distance or time. It was not gentle. It was not supposed to be. Elara stood before him, 300 wolves watching, and she tilted her head to expose her throat. And the vulnerability of the gesture, the trust it required, silenced the hall completely. "I spent 11 years humming my mother's lullaby to empty rooms," she said quietly for him. "And you heard it through 3 floors of stone." "I will always hear you," he said. "That is not a promise. That is what I am." He bit her. The mark burned. She felt it as heat, then as light, then as a connection so profound that she could feel his heartbeat inside her own chest. A second pulse layered over hers, and his thoughts brushed against hers. Not words, but textures. The deep amber warmth of his devotion, the fierce gold of his protectiveness, the quiet, steady certainty that he had found what he had been looking for. Her wolf howled. Inside her, silver and luminous, howling in recognition and joy, and his wolf howled back, dark and vast and ancient, and the two sounds met and merged and filled the hall, not audibly, not physically, but in the way that mattered, in the space where wolves lived underneath their human skins. 300 wolves felt it. 300 wolves dropped to one knee. Not because they were commanded, because the bond between their king and their new Luna was something they could feel, a resonance in the pack bond, a frequency that their wolves responded to, the way tuning forks respond to their matching note. It was recognition. It was acceptance. Elara, with the mark fresh on her neck and the taste of blood in her mouth where she had bitten her lip, looked out at the kneeling hall and felt, for the first time in her life, the full weight of belonging. Not belonging to someone. Belonging with someone. Belonging among people who chose to kneel, not because they were forced, but because what they felt was real. She looked at Kael. He was looking at her with those amber eyes, and there was blood on his lips, her blood. And his expression was not triumphant, not possessive, not any of the things she had expected. It was something quieter, something more permanent. He looked like a man who had been carrying a weight for 9 years and had finally, finally set it down. She reached up and touched his face, the scar from temple to jaw. She traced it with her fingertip, and his eyes closed, and 300 wolves watched their Alpha King lean into an Omega's touch like a man leaning into sunlight. That night, in the Queen's chambers that were now hers, Ilara stood at the window and looked at the full moon. It was enormous, white gold, close enough to touch, and its light fell through the colored glass and made patterns on the floor, blue and gold, the same patterns that had been waiting for someone to stand in them for 23 years. Kael came up behind her. He did not touch her. He simply stood close enough that she could feel the heat of him, and they both looked at the moon. "I am going to replant the entire healing garden," she said. "All right. And I am going to retrain your fortress healer, because her golden seal storage is criminal." "All right. And I am going to open the healing house to wolves from other packs, not just yours, because silver poisoning does not care about territorial borders." He was quiet for a moment. "That will make certain lords uncomfortable." "Good," he laughed, the same quiet, bewildered laugh she had heard through the door on the first night, and she turned and looked up at him, and in the moonlight his face was all shadows and light, like a painting of something too large to fit on canvas. "My mother would have liked you," she said. "Why?" "She believed that healing was not a gift to be hidden. She said it was a debt, that every time you healed someone, you were paying back the moon for the power it gave you, and the debt was never finished. And that was the point, that the work never ends." "That sounds exhausting." "It is." "Good. You will need something to do while I am in tedious council meetings." She laughed, and the sound filled the queen's chambers, and the colored glass caught the moonlight and threw blue and gold across their faces. And somewhere deep in the fortress, in the dungeon where a humming voice had traveled through 3 floors of stone and found the only ears that mattered, a copper pipe dripped steadily onto the cell floor, marking time that no longer needed to be counted. Ilara hummed the lullaby one more time, not from pain, not from loneliness, not from the desperate need to go somewhere else in her mind. She hummed it because it was beautiful, and because her mother had given it to her, and because the man standing behind her could hear it, would always hear it. And that was enough. The 5 notes climbed. The 3 notes fell. The pause. The phrase that opened up into something vast. Kael's hand found hers in the dark. Outside, the moon watched, as it always had, as it always would, patient and silver and full.